You're tuned to Tidings, and I'm Hazel Kahn. My guest today is Danny Gregory, who is also my son. Danny is talking to us on Skype from Manhattan, where he lives. He's a prolific artist and blogger with a creative presence in many digital spaces, including one that offers online video courses. He's also the author of several books, but recently he entered new territory for the first time. He wrote about it on his blog, which is where I saw it. Welcome, Danny, to Tidings and to WPKN.
Nice to be here.
Tell all our listeners what you've been up to recently and how this all began.
Well, I love books, and I think that that has been the thing that has joined together all of my creative endeavors really my entire life. I've always loved books. I think that's a love that I probably first acquired from you when I was little. You know, I began certainly by reading books, but from the very, very beginning, I wanted to make books. And I remember being 4, 5, 6 years old, and I started to write my own books. It wasn't just about writing stories. It was really about making a book. And I can remember making books where I would write a story on one side of the page, and I would do a drawing and illustration of that part of the story to go with it on the other side of the page. And filling little booklets that were made, you know, by taking a bunch of piece of paper and stapling them in the middle. And there was just something really powerful to me about that. I remember one particular book I wrote about a knight who was accompanied by a dachshund. And they would go on adventures. And I just remember that those drawings of this knight walking along with this little dachshund next to him and them traveling here and there. And then on the other side, writing these stories about it. So, you know, and I would draw with crayons and pencils. And it felt very important to me somehow, having this book. I remember writing the title page and making covers. It was really important to me to have it feel as book-like as possible. And I also was very interested in libraries, and I had a library of my own where I took all of my books and I reorganized them on the shelves, and I would arrange them by size, by thickness, by author, by title, by subject, by the color of their spines. There were just so many different ways of organizing books. And I remember once when I was 8 or 9, saying to you, my mom, would you go into my room, take a book off the shelf and move it somewhere else? And I came back in to the room and I was able to tell what the book was, where it was now, where it had been, sort of like a weird librarian idiot savant. But it was really important to me, and I made little signs to go on the spines of the books that said, you know, sort of Dewey Decimal labels that you'd see on a book, and I made little cards to go in the back. And I actually ended up making kind of a lending library and lending library books to other kids in the neighborhood who never returned them. So after a certain point, the library was closed down. But just really loved books that way. And
do you know how many books you had at that time?
I don't think that there were that many. I think there were probably 4 or 5 shelves worth. I remember they were at the base of my bed. I had a bookshelf that sat at the foot of my bed, and I would lie there in bed and I would just stare at those spines. And I remember I would go and I would pilfer other bookshelves in the house or even at my grandparents' house because I wanted to collect books that had similar spines. So for instance, Penguin books that had black spines that were histories, and they had green spines that were science. There were blue ones that were something else, and there were orange ones that were fiction. And there was something to me just so kind of beautiful and completist about having a shelf that was all the same colored spines, all arranged in a row. I wrote a lot in those days. I remember one book I wrote was about dog care. That was my real goal in life, was to become a vet.
Not a librarian.
No. I had no interest in doing that with other people. It was just my own books. But I wrote this book that was about dog care and took photographs of our dog. And they were basically just copies of other dog books that I'd found. But I remember one in particular about cleaning a dog's ears with cotton balls and like examining their teeth. And so we took our dog Pogo and took all these photographs of her, like as I pulled her teeth back. And then when the pictures came back from the photo lab, I pasted them all into the book, and I hand-wrote little captions in italics underneath each one. Figure one, you know, retracting the canine lips, kind of thing. So anyway, so I created this book of dog care. I wrote lots of other books, too. I mean, I wrote stories, I wrote plays, I wrote novellas.
Sorry, this is handwriting, or what were you writing on?
Well, eventually I sort of learned to type. I sort of taught myself how to type. I remember using an electric typewriter you had, but then I got my own typewriter. I think it was a manual typewriter. And I was never a good touch typist. To this day, I don't type particularly well. But I spent a lot of time typing, and I would type out little books, and then I would type them with carbon paper, so I had additional copies in case I needed to submit them somewhere. I don't know, I think there may have been a point where I sent in stories to magazines and collected a bunch of rejection notices, but mainly it was about accumulation and having these little plastic folders and manila envelopes that contained them all and ordered them, and they were in cardboard boxes or they were in ring binders all arranged with dividers and stuff like that. So the whole kind of fetishism of paper and manuscripts and stuff like that was really important to me.
This is book porn.
Sort of, yeah, sort of. I mean, it was very much about my books that I felt that way about them, you know. I mean, I think you understood it because I think you had a similar kind of interest in paper and pens and stuff like that. But I think most of my friends knew nothing about it. It certainly wasn't the kind of thing I would sort of boast about.
Embarrassed by them? If your friends came?
It wasn't the kind of thing that you talk about, you know. That was my own thing. I mean, I think it was this fantasy that I had of myself of being an author. And my uncle, Michael, who's your brother, he was an author, and he was known in the family as an author. And every member of the family, when he went to visit my grandparents or my great aunt or any of the members of the extended family, they always had a shelf that had his books on them. And there were six of them. They were kind of academic books about anti-Semitism or about the Holocaust or something like that. But there was a row of books, spines with his name on the jacket, and he was very authorial. He had, you know, he smoked a pipe, he had a beard, he, you know, he had a Selectric typewriter, and he would sit in his house and he would play, you know, Brahms and Schubert Lieder on the gramophone, and, you know, and to me it was a fantasy of sort of a way of being a grown-up. Then when I was in high school, you know, I continued to write stories. I think I was less into making books at that point, but I would certainly continue to write a lot. And I worked on the school paper. I was the associate editor or something. But I remember, I think it was in 9th or 10th grade, I saw my name, my byline for the first time. And that was like really exciting. And I remember, I mean, I have photographic recall of what those articles looked like, seeing columns of type with my name on it. I think I still have copies of those things. So that was really powerful thing for me. And then...
But you obviously have photographic recall of all of this that you've been talking about.
Yeah, I have like sensory memories of it. I mean, I can remember smells of libraries. A few years ago, I found a website that I can't remember what it is now, but basically it was run by book lovers. And if you could remember any details of a book, you just put them into this website. And within a short amount of time, somebody would come back to you and say, this is the book you're talking about. And so I went into it. All I could remember about various books I hadn't seen since I was 7 or 8 years old, because we moved a lot. And when we moved, all of the books didn't necessarily make the cut and come with us. So there are a lot of books I just didn't have anymore. But I remember writing one book, writing down, it's a book about two boys in Africa. There's a scene where they're in a hot air balloon and they're listening to bad guys talking in a car. Within, you know, half an hour, somebody written back and said, oh, that's African Adventure by so-and-so. I went onto Google, I found that book, and within 3 days I was holding it in my hand, and it was just a really powerful thing. I had read that book when I was 9, sitting in the back of a classroom in a kibbutz in Israel, and I remembered it so vividly, and just to see it 40 years later was just really cool. So I collected back some of those books that I remember from childhood, and I have a lot of those now. Just recalling them, and, you know, I'm sort of like reassembling that library. Well, then when I went to college, I wrote my thesis. And that was very exciting to me because it was bound in a kind of somewhat crude way, academic way, cardboard covers and a taped spine. But it was a legitimate book that was typed and had my name on the cover. And I always remember when you did your PhD thesis and you had two copies of your book, you had a ream of paper that you had bound at the same time. And I still have that as a book in light blue cloth. And it was my sketchbook on and off through adolescence. And I just remember that idea of, like, you could actually get a book made for yourself. a really intoxicating thought.
And it was just blank, the same as my thesis?
Yeah.
I never knew that. I don't remember that.
I mean, your thesis hopefully wasn't blank. Literally, I think you took like a ream of typing paper.
It was professionally bound.
Yeah. Cloth bound. You know, and then when I was in my 20s, it became more commonplace. You know, desktop publishing became. You could set type and you could make, you know, things that looked like books or looked like newspapers or looked like magazine articles. And I would do a lot of that. I would write stories. I would write stories for my girlfriend and wife about, you know, fictional events that had happened to us. And you could put in pictures. And that was really nice. And I also made little books for her. I would write a story. And I had a laser printer. And I would print these books out. And sometimes I would, you know, find ways of rebinding them, sometimes with punch holes and little grommets that went through it. And I would make little books. And I made a lot of them in that period. Anyway, so about 20 years ago, I took some courses in bookbinding so I could actually finally bind some books. And I did it because I had started drawing and I wanted to make my own sketchbooks because I couldn't find blank sketchbooks that I really liked the size off of the paper. So this is a good excuse for doing it. You know, there was something about making this what's called a case-bound book, you know, which is a book that has an actual spine and a cover. It's not a booklet. It's not a binder. It's like a real book where the pages are, you know, glued in, bound in, sewn in. But it was kind of a mysterious thing. I had no idea like quite how it worked. I'd certainly dissected books, but I didn't really know what was the process of making one and putting it together. So I took this class.
Where was that?
It was at the Center for Book Arts here in New York, and which is an amazing place that teaches lots of these kinds of skills. And I took it. It was like an evening workshop. I took it over the course of several months. I'm an enthusiastic bookbinder, but not a very fastidious one. So my books tended to be slightly an angle or slightly lumpy with, you know, too much glue, or, you know, occasionally I cut my finger and there would be a spot of blood in the book, that kind of thing. But they were mine. I had made them. And then...
Did you get better with time, or was it, were you inherently not perfect?
Yeah, I wasn't. I mean, I took this class and I made several books during the class, but then I made my own setup at home. I bought a paper cutter, I made myself a press, and I did it at home. But, you know, I was always rushed and I would, you know, do things too fast. And so they were never perfect. But in a way, that to me was fine. That was part of the form of their handmade books, so they didn't look. I also met a bookbinder on the Lower East Side who was a Hasidic Jew, and he ran a business where they basically did bookbinding for synagogues, and then he also did bookbinding of magazines for libraries. You know, you go into a library and they have all the magazines, you know, with gold stamps on the spine. And I had him make me the perfect sketchbook, and I said, like, I'm going to spend as much as I want to make a really, really good sketchbook. And he made me the sketchbook that had lots of different kinds of paper in it and had sort of a leather cover and had my name stamped in gold on it. And it was just way too much, and I barely ever used it. So I did get to that. It was too big. It was too fancy. It was just, but it was a cool experience. It was like, you know, it was like dating a supermodel. Anyway, so eventually I wrote books. I started to kind of achieve some of the things that I fantasized about with my uncle. I'd see my books in a bookstore, and I would see them, you know, people reading them. I'd see them in libraries. And
what was the first book that you published?
Which was called Hello World, A Life in Ham Radio. And it was a book about a man who was a ham radio operator. It was about his life, which is a weird topic for me because I didn't really know very much about it. But through a series of circumstances, I fell into the situation where I got to write a book. And to me, what was important was I got to write a book. That was the main thing. So the fact that it was about ham radio wasn't really that important. After that, I wrote an illustrated memoir called Everyday Matters. And then I wrote a book, The Creative License, and a bunch of other books. And so now my books have been translated. I have my shelf in my house that has all of my books and all the foreign editions. And, you know, that's like my six-year-old fantasy has finally come true.
Do you arrange and rearrange them by color, date, or?
No, they're arranged by chronology.
And do you look at them as a set like that sometimes?
Yeah. They're at eye height, the shelf that's at eye height. So I was just looking at them a couple of days ago. Yeah, so I look at them quite often.
Just to look at them?
No, I just sort of like look at their heft. In fact, I rearranged them yesterday because I kind of rearranged the foreign editions so that they were not in chronological order, but they were with the title that they were the translation of. So it continues.
And is there room on that shelf for more?
Oh, yeah, yes. I'll gladly empty the rest of the case to fill it up one day. So,
Danny Gregory, author, artist, and blogger, is talking about letterpress printing. This is Hazel Kahn and Tidings on WPKN Radio.
Yeah, so anyways, last few weeks I took a class. I went back to the Center for Book Arts, which I haven't been to for quite a while, and I wanted to take a class on letterpress printing, which, you know, is where you take basically individual letters and you set type. And it's really a form of printing that's kind of obsolete now, but it is the type of printing that Gutenberg developed. And the Center for Book Arts has about 10 presses. The newest one, I think, is from the 60s. And they have all these cases full of type. So you open a drawer, big wooden drawer, and it will have one typeface. You know, you open it and there'll be, you know, Bernhard Modern 12 point will fill an entire case. And then if you want Bernhard Modern in 14, you open another drawer. There are a lot of typefaces that only have one size in them. So it's a really different experience than setting something on your computer where you can just go through hundreds of different typefaces. It's more selective, and there aren't, you know, in between type sizes, you know, it's 12, 14, 24, 48, and so forth. You can't get 23.5 like you can on InDesign.
These are as ancient as the presses?
There are people who still will make you a font now, but it's a big process. The reason that they have all these presses is because when some old pressman would die or a printing shop would close, the families would know what to do with all the stuff, and so they would just donate it to the Center for Book Arts. And so they just accumulate all these typefaces. So I think it would be really expensive and impossible to get a lot of new ones. Sometimes you'll go through and they'll be missing certain letters, but by and large, they were pretty complete. You could certainly print a lot of stuff, and a lot of artists use it because, again, you're printing these sort of specialized things. There's an art form called making broadsides, which are basically an individual large print, and people will take a poem or something like that, and there's a whole art of typesetting and printmaking with different color types and different kinds of paper, and it's really quite beautiful. So, yeah, so all the letters out individually, and you lay it out on a stick, and then...
The stick is kind of, is it like a Scrabble?
Yeah, it's sort of like that, except you can adjust the length of it because you sort of set the length of the type. But, yeah, so it's basically like a tray with a lip, and you set them all down there. And then there are also wooden type. So there's letters that are sometimes really large, like they may be 6 inches tall, like if you imagine like printing a circus poster, or even like the front page of the New York Post or something. So you arrange them all, and then you lock it into a press, and then you ink it, and then you start to make prints.
Can I just interrupt? I think you also wrote that you have to put all the spaces in.
Right.
As physical objects as the letters are.
Right, exactly. There's different thicknesses of pieces of metal that you're slotting between the letters. And then you also have to, you know, we're used to that term leading. Now, you know, when you do leading on a desktop publishing, well, leading is actually a slice of lead strip that you slide between the rows of letters, and you can vary that depending on what you want the look of it to be. So there's lots of decisions to make in terms of, obviously, what type you're going to use, how big it's going to be, the letter spacing between the letters, or how you're going to rag it, all those kinds of things. But they're not decisions that are made lightly because you have to physically do it all, and it can take hours to, you know, set a few lines. You know, so it's an interesting world that I wasn't really familiar with. So you take a term like leading, you know, but there's a lot of language that came out of the world of printing that I kind of wasn't aware of. So for instance, the term to coin a phrase. So it's not coin, C-O-I-N, it's actually coin, Q-U-O-I-N, because the thing that you use to lock the letters into the press is called a coin. So to coin a phrase means you're basically assembling a phrase and locking it into the press. Mind your P's and Q's comes from when you're pulling letters out of the drawer. The P's and the Q's, they're backwards, of course. And so they look very similar, like B's and D's do. So mind your P's and Q's, you know, refers to, obviously, don't mix up your letters. You know, the wrong end of the stick, again, the stick is the thing that you're arranging the letters on. And if you arrange them backwards, that's the wrong end of the stick. And uppercase and lowercase comes from the fact that this is literally drawers in a case like a chest of drawers. And the top of the case is the uppercase and lowercase is the bottom. So that's where that term comes from. And get the lead out, close up the form, get, you know, make sure you're letters of space properly, but let's move on. Let's get the light out and move on. So it's interesting that world of printing, that, you know, even that technology may not really be used anymore, but it's become a great part of our life.
And also, in the beginning, I was a bit confused when I was reading, because there's also, we always want to call them fonts, but you call them face. And of course, it's typeface. I mean, it comes from typeface.
I think so. I'm not entirely familiar, comfortable with it. I know that we use fonts to refer, so I kind of wanted to seem like I was cool and blending in with the typographers. So I just called them typefaces. And so I now reserve the word font for computers. And I'm sure that there's more an expert could tell us about that.
You also said that the things that you put in the spaces and in between the rows is called furniture. Is that right?
Furniture is the stuff that locks around the type. So you put the type down and then you have to build out to fill the bed of the press because you don't want the type shifting around. So that's called furniture. Yeah, so anyway, so I experienced it was very... Overall, I felt like it was a week well spent because my job is generally sitting at a computer most of the time and sitting down and looking at a screen. And this is an opportunity to kind of make a similar thing, words on a page, but to do it in a really much more physical, you know, I'm going around and selecting the letters and making all these decisions that are really a different kind of decision. So for me, creatively, it was just an opportunity to try something different. And I think I had to work against that because when I first started thinking about, well, what is the ultimate project that I want to work on, I went on the computer and I built it in InDesign. I said, okay, this is what I want it to look like. And I printed it out and I took it with me. Thing, I thought, okay, I'll just try and reproduce that. And the first thing, of course, I encountered was they didn't have those fonts. Even if I arranged ones that were similar, they didn't stack up the same way. And then I realized also, but if I did this whole thing, you know, this technology actually is able to do things that a computer can't do easily. So, for instance, the printing itself is much more tactile. You can feel how the type has embedded, debossed into the paper. You know, you can feel the letters sunk in. You know, we've all had that experience of like a really nice business card where you can see that the ink is actually inside the paper. It's embedded, pushed into the paper. You know, a computer printer obviously won't do that. But also, you know, computer printers, they are very regular. And this system can be regular, but also it can have organic aspects to it that are more analog, like, for instance, using wooden type. This is type that has scratches and nicks in it. And they have slightly, you know, uneven edges. When you lay it out, it doesn't quite conform and lock exactly as tight as a computer font would do. So there's inherently an organic feeling to what you're printing out. And also when you're printing it, you're printing with colored ink. Colored ink, it can be really beautiful. And the colors of it are really amazing. And they're way more vivid than anything I've ever seen come out of a color printer. And I was able to print with gold ink, which looks like real gold. I mean, it doesn't look like, you know, brown like it does when it comes out of the computer. So I decided like midway through the week that I was completely wrong in trying to create a project that I could create on the computer. I should try and create something that I could only create this way. And so I ended up doing something where I took a poem by Ogden Nash and I set it in wooden type mixed with metal type, and I kind of blurred the inks in different colors with each other, and it came out looking kind of funky. And you know, you could probably spend a huge amount of time and reproduce it on the computer, but I like the idea that I was creating, rather than trying to reproduce the computer thing, I was creating something that would be almost impossible to do it that way. That is connected for me to what I do with books now, which is drawing and sketchbooks. So drawing and sketchbooks is about filling up a book with an analog thing, a handmade thing. And also with a lot of the books that I've written, I've created the typeface. I've hand lettered a lot of the captions. I've drawn most of the illustrations. So most of my books do not look like they were made by a computer. They look like they were handmade. So I think that that's interesting that we live so much in this world of technology, and to get away from it, and also to get in touch with the history. I mean, I felt like I was making stuff. They had presses there that looked like a press that Ben Franklin would have had, you know, and you can imagine people publishing, you know, printing newspapers or something like that in the revolutionary times with the same technology. I felt connected going back to the monks that, you know, first started doing all this stuff. It felt really different than the kind of hard line that separates technology creativity from the past. And I also liked the fact that it took a different kind of thinking, took investment. It was also fun to learn something brand new that was a new skill, and you know, to know that I wasn't necessarily going to be good at it, but it was just a different way of thinking. There's something really nice about, you know, having permission to be incompetent. and to kind of blunder through things. So that was fun as well.
Are you going to remain that way, or are you going to try and improve your skills?
No, I don't feel like I need to be a good printer. I learned a lot from it, and I imagine that I will do it again. You know, I mean, the problem was, in part, I don't know quite how to use it yet, what the end goal of it is. But, I mean, I definitely feel good knowing that I know how to do it, and knowing that I know enough how to be sort of dangerous. Same with bookbinding.
So now you could actually do a letterpress book.
Yeah, I mean, it would be a phenomenal amount of work, but yeah.
Maybe you have to wear a monk habit to be really good at it.
You know, when you think about what it was like to print a Bible or something, you know, and you think about how much work there was and how much perfection, it is a kind of a monastic. I think things are too easy for us now in a way. It's too easy to make something. You know, it's too easy to write a symphony. And I think to be able to just get back in touch with origins and the care that you take, because when you take that much time to make something well, you really think about it in a much more in-depth way. You consider things so much more carefully. Beginning, of course, with writing, because you don't want to be slipshod in your writing if you're then going to spend a huge amount of time typesetting it and printing it. You want to make sure that you've chosen exactly the right words, unlike knocking out an email on my phone or something.
Yeah, so you entered that world, and I mean, so you think you can straddle both worlds a little bit.
I think doing that informs the other things that I do. You know, I think it's about breaking your habits and not getting too locked into one way of doing things and allowing yourself to be influenced by other things, you know, and being influenced by history and being influenced by radically different ways of doing things. I think that that's a key part of being a creative person, refreshing your spirit in that way and, you know, getting new insights, new points of view on what you make. So that was an important experience for me.
Mm-hmm. Great. Danny, it was really, really interesting. Tell people how they can get to your blog, get to this particular post and to anything else that you do, you know, how they can learn more about you.
Yeah, so you can go to DannyGregory.com or you can go to DannyGregory'sBlog.com. And, you know, this particular piece that I wrote is called Letter Pressed. I've been making a lot of videos recently and exploring the history of sketchbooks. And so a lot of my blog is full of those kind of videos, but there are a lot of written things in there. I've been blogging since 2003. There's plenty to read. And I've also written, I don't know, a dozen books or so.
Very good. Thank you very much. Great. I'm really happy with this, Danny.
Hope you good.
I was a little bit apprehensive, you know, about interviewing you, but I think it worked out. Do you?
Yeah. It was a lot of fun. It was nice to share the story with you. And it was, you know, I think your show is really great, so it's an honor to be part of it.
You've been listening to Danny Gregory describing how his lifelong interest in making books led him most recently to learning about letterpress printing. You can hear Tidings on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. All Tidings programs are archived on hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.